Welcome to Tax Breaks, a podcast by the Federation of Tax Administrators, where we delve into current subjects and their relevance to the realm of tax administration. Each episode of the podcast features conversations with esteemed professionals from government, academia, and the private sector. Our guests generously share their wealth of knowledge and unique perspectives, providing invaluable insights and expertise to our listeners. I'm Ryan Minnick, FTA's Chief Operating Officer, and this week I'm joined by Maryland's Chief Deputy Comptroller, Andy Schaffel. Now, I've known Andy for many years, almost my entire career at FTA, and he's always thinking about data optimization and how he can enable the team at the Maryland Comptroller to best utilize resources in service to the taxpayers of the state. From the importance of data safety and data privacy to the value that KPIs, or key performance indicators, can provide to leaders, you won't want to miss this conversation. It's one of our longest to date, and it is so full of insights into data, how data is utilized, and the importance of data to help leaders make decisions without actually getting trapped in the data, which I think is a really important insight. And Andy talks a little bit more about that. So without further ado, here's my conversation with Chief Deputy Comptroller Andy Schaffel. Andy Schaffel, it's exciting to have you on Tax Breaks, finally. We've talked about this a couple of times, and then I think I finally cornered you, and you couldn't say no. So welcome.
Yeah, you're persistent, Ryan. Thank you. I'm excited to be here. My favorite subject, data.
You know, well, I had a feeling when I said data and KPIs, like this would be a fun conversation. So for our public listeners, folks that don't come to our conferences, haven't talked about this topic a while, I think it's fair to lay a little groundwork. I know you really well. I used to be a resident of the great state of Maryland and got to know you and the team because you were just down the street and you were my really good reason to, instead of commuting into DC on Fridays, go grab lunch and hear about the cool things Maryland was working on. So appreciate that over the years. But for you, you're, you know, Chief Deputy Comptroller over the tax function, the Maryland Comptroller's Office. Maryland Comptroller set up a little bit differently than every other tax agency. But your journey to that role in particular, I think, is unique and lends itself to the conversation we're going to have. So if you wouldn't mind sharing a little bit about how you ended up in public service and kind of your background and how you arrived in your current role, just to kind of level set before we get started.
Yeah, sure. No, thank you. I think we discussed this at NESTOA amongst many of the commissioners. Most of us didn't start tax with, yeah, I'm going into tax. You know, I think very few people get into tax, and that was what they thought about. That was like, this is my predetermined career. This is where I'm headed. I have a very different background, I think, than most. When I came out of college, I was an economics major and a management minor. I came out in the middle of a recession, not long after 9/11. Obviously dating myself there. And I didn't really know what I wanted to do, like so many. I knew I wanted to one day run a business, which is obviously not what I'm doing. And I went to work for Walmart, because in my mind, that was one of the most impressive businesses I'd ever seen. I read Sam Walton's book. I was fascinated. And I ended up very quickly moving into having my own store in Baltimore City, which was a ton of fun. I met my wife there. And the reason I was able to ascend was because I didn't really know it at the time, but I was kind of subconsciously embracing their data model. They are all about, and especially at that time, their just-in-time inventory. That remains a very popular subject. And Walmart's a very easy business model. If you put something on a shelf and you price it, it will sell, period. That's it.
Makes sense.
And I kind of figured out how to really properly manage the data in the inventory system to best move that just-in-time cycle with the staff, and we broke a lot of sales and profit records. It was fantastic. But I knew I didn't want to do that the rest of my life. I was working 70 hours a week. I was getting bored. I had the fortunate ability, after a bonus, to spend a full-time year in grad school. I went back and did an MBA. I fell back in love with economics. And I ended up applying for a job with the state of Maryland as an economist. And that job was in the Comptroller of Maryland's office. And boom, there's my entry. So I came into the tax world really through economics, tax policy, revenue forecasting, that side of the equation.
Awesome. Well, and it's interesting because you know, you and I have a shared trait in that we work in traditionally very stuffy fields, but we tend to be, at least, you know, in my opinion, the echo chamber here, we tend to be a little bit clearer when we're communicating with people not in our chosen fields about what's going on, right? So if I talk about technology, I don't often put people to sleep. You have an economics background, but you can talk about numbers in a context that doesn't put business leaders to sleep. That's interesting about the Walmart thing. I didn't know that about you.
Yeah.
So yeah, once you get bored mastering the supply chain feedback loop that is Walmart, you know, then MBA, comptroller's office, and then you briefly worked more broadly on economic data in the state, right? On your way to your current role.
That's right. Yeah, I was the state's chief economist for a period of time. I've been on different councils for the state, different private sector councils as well, kind of all over the place in the world of economics. And I like the math side of economics. I love the data side of economics. I would characterize myself more as a behavioral economist. I'm really fascinated by the human condition and how that plays within incentives. Mm-hmm. That's really what kind of animates me on the economic side. And it's really translated into my tax administration side too. You know, I think trying to understand our tax base and how best to serve them, that sort of behavioral aspect has really come into play there.
Absolutely. I would say that, yeah, tax data tends to be almost exclusively behavioral data, right? So that's got to be fascinating. So I guess to, you know, let's talk about the data part of data and KPIs, because I think that helps people understand what data we're working with. I was really impressed when I came into the tax world, not from a tax agency and just kind of from the private sector. And you know, data in the private sector, we have mountains of data regardless of industry, and we leverage it every which way all the time. But then when I came into tax agency, my outsider view was, okay, income tax returns. That was the extent of my personal experience. I didn't run a company, wasn't registered for sales tax, didn't have to deal with any of those things. But then getting in and realizing that that's, you know, the first order data, return data, but then there's all this other ancillary data that we collect all the time. It's validation data from third parties. It's other data from state agencies. It's federal data in order to correlate and make sure people are, you know, not only being truthful, but in some cases, you know, getting the most benefit that they can possibly get. There's a lot of different ways to slice it. So where do you see, I think I already know the answer to this, but where do you see data as it relates to like the function of tax administration? Like what's its role? And how does that inform kind of your perspective now as not only a data person, but a executive leader of an agency, of a tax function of an agency?
Yeah, wow, it's a big question. You know, I think data, right, we all talk about data, and data has so many different uses. And when I think about it in the world of tax, I kind of break it into four different categories. One is compliance, right? And that's you were getting to that with some of those data sources, and it's an obvious use. Another is tax policy, my old stomping grounds. And then I look at the operational KPIs or metrics, and then what I would call just discovery, operational discovery. I think those are kind of the four paths that I really, or buckets, I say, that I put the work into as we're pursuing different data strategies. And I'm sorry, I kind of got lost there.
You were there. I mean, so the discovery part's really interesting because I think that's where the kind of management perspective comes in, because oftentimes, and we'll talk about KPIs in a minute, but oftentimes management, you know, it's KPI, KPI, KPI. We hear that in the private sector. It's a, you know, very, you know, KPIs are central to, you know, Six Sigma and lean process and all these other things that we follow on every industry. But discovery, I like your characterization of it. So maybe explain that a little bit further, because I think I know what you're getting at.
Yeah. I mean, it's, I'm not sure that I fully know what it is sometimes. I think it's when you're working in the data, it's challenging. In most cases, you don't always know what all of your data means. You don't always know how it relates to things. You don't always know how it relates to the business use. So as you're working on, in my experience, most of my discovery began digging deeper into a KPI or digging deeper into a tax policy issue. And then you sort of spot something. And it maybe might not exactly be what you're chasing at that moment in time, but but you've seen something. You may not really know what it is. You may really not know what it means, but it's worth coming back to at some point. And at that point, where that's taken me is just down some deep rabbit holes. And, you know, 20-25% of them pay off. But that's mm-hmm. where we really find something that leads to a systematic change usually. KPIs, I feel like, usually help you refine. Discovery takes you to like a systematic change, something you're going to do probably very differently or a whole different way of approaching something.
Sure. No, I like that. Example that popped into my mind was talking to a lean process expert a few years back in Washington State. And that was a big initiative. One of their governors was really big into lean process. So they sent out this like lean strike force to all these different agencies. And this was one of the leaders of that strike force. We were just having a conversation. And he shared with me that they were working with the DMV in the state. And they were specifically working in this one unit, trying to help them embody and understand what lean process was, which isn't what we're talking about today. But the discovery piece was they had a disproportionate number of phone calls routing to this unit. It was weird. They were like bypassing the call center. It was all going directly to this unit. They couldn't figure out why. So they were digging a little deeper conversationally with the staff. And one of the kind of line workers said, you know, when you guys, as you all work on this, if you could get rid of the fake money charges that we do. And the guy's like, what do you mean fake money charges? That doesn't make any sense. Well, it's the something in their module for renewing your registration for a very specific registration type. I don't know if it was like a CDL. It wasn't just generic registrations. It was something very narrow. But that module had a coding error in it. And so sometimes if you were paying with a debit card, the module would error out after the debit had been authorized, but it never processed through. So you'd end up, especially if somebody got frustrated, they could submit something two or three times right. and, you know, have a bunch of funds holding on their bank account. And then they would get frustrated and they would call. Well, they discovered two things in that conversation, all driven by just investigating the data. One was this error in the system that was super easy for the programmers to fix. They didn't even know it was happening. The second was the phone number on the website for that very specific registration purpose during some overhaul of their website was that poor frontline worker's desk number.
That one employee's desk
number. So that's ultimately why all these calls were disproportionately coming in. Mm-hmm. But again, good employees doing what they do, they figure it out.
Right.
And I like your notion of data discovery because it's a little bit more like art and science together because you see something, it's just not quite right. And whether you figure it out that day or maybe it's just an anomaly and you're like, oh, that's interesting. I wonder why that is. But that's fascinating. Well before we go.
Your example there is spot on too. It just didn't occur to me as we're having this conversation, but I think every time you talk to people on the business side and the rank and file, the foot soldiers that are doing all the work, they know everything. They don't always know what they know, right? And they don't necessarily know the significance of the times. It's often an annoyance, right? Yep. But that is some of the most meaningful information out there. It's hard to capture.
Oh, yeah.
But that is it.
Yeah, I'm always amazed talking to the compliance folks that come in, you know, and they're still leaders in their areas when they come to our conferences and things, but they have such a grasp of those functions and the nuances and the behaviors that take place in there. And part of the, you know, the magic that I like about being on the FTA side is that we get to kind of mine that gold and say, I wonder if everybody around the country thinks about it this way. Yeah. Like this one state has this one really cool thing that they're doing. And it could be something as boring as this is a key piece of information that we ask people for when they fill out an application for something. And this one key piece of information like helps us almost 99% of the time make sure that we assign the right industry to them. So instead of using NAICS codes, we ask them a certain question and we do some matching on our end. Because a lot of the compliance, you know, there's a lot of things that happen with data, but
I'm listening to that because NAICS codes are a pain point for me and such a good data point, but a pain.
As a former federal contractor, NAICS codes drive me crazy. I still have nightmares about NAICS codes and I haven't had to use them in ages in the nonprofit world. But I guess I started a little bit ahead talking about data because for people who, we're 13 minutes in, we should clarify, data in the tax world is our single most valuable, guarded, protected asset, right? So a lot of what we're talking about today, this is downstream of all the table stakes stuff. And so tax administrators listening already get it, but curious public or maybe tax professionals who are hanging out and listening to this today, like data privacy and data security, not just when data is received, like how we protect it, but even how we use the data is so critical.
That's right.
So I don't know if there's anything about that you want to talk about really quick, but that way, as we talk about all this other cool data stuff, people don't think that we're just all willy-nilly going through data here. Now, we have really specific processes and procedures and tax.
100%. And to amplify your point, security is number one, first and foremost. We spend a tremendous amount of money, a tremendous amount of effort on it. Tax data and the data that supports the tax forms, the tax process, is the most intimate data out there. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, I guess maybe my Amazon shopping history is sort of, it's not too risque, but like, you know, there's that's a different side of data, right? This is your mm-hmm. income, and people are sensitive about that. This mm-hmm. is your income. This is how your family is funded. This is, in many cases, how you spend a lot of your money too, right? Like now, mm-hmm. now we have more and more benefits and tax expenditures wrapped up in all this. You can really tie quite the, you know, you can really put people into certain different buckets and learn a whole lot about who they are. And I don't mean that from a Big Brother standpoint, but I mean that from like an intimacy point. It is mm-hmm. it is everything to people. It is the richest data out there. And our number one goal is to secure that data. You know, as anybody that's a tax professional mm-hmm. on here will know, Pub 1075 is often one of the biggest headaches we have, but we all welcome that headache. You know,
oh,
a lot of resources towards it. You know, nothing personal out there to our IRS partners. They can be a real pain in the butt sometimes, but I really value them. I mean, it's necessary. Mm-hmm. You know, and it goes all the way from securing our data relative to our network and access rights and everything like that, all the way down to like my data in my box is scrambled. If you were to steal my physical box, mm-hmm. you're walking out of there with nothing with the encryption. So, you know, it's. I think we're very broad in our security process, all the way down to somebody literally stealing a physical piece of hardware. You know?
Oh, absolutely. I would say, with my perspective coming in from a cybersecurity data security standpoint, you've got compliance frameworks like 1075, super rich compliance frameworks. And ultimately, the collaboration is where compliance frameworks work, right? So the fact that the IRS unit that does that works with agencies to make sure that, you know, every agency operates differently. You all have different data warehouses, different vendors, different providers, different hardware, software that you use. But what is staggering to me, of every industry out there, and make no mistake, the tax industry, highly targeted. We see it all the time. We see attempts. We see all of these, you know, criminals would love to have this data. But public trust is super hard to earn.
Yes.
And super easy to lose. And the one question I love asking people, and there are people in my, like, you know, personal network, I don't just ask people this on the street, but it's, do you even think about the data you're giving a tax agency when you click submit on your tax return? Do you just, you know, you just trust that it's going to the right place and the right thing's going to happen? And I have yet, you know, knock on wood, yet to have somebody tell me when I ask that question, oh yeah, I am super worried about it. No, they believe they have a relationship with a tax agency. I mean, tax agency is probably, it's your biggest relationship you have in the place that you live, because you're giving them, to your point, the most intimate data you possibly can. And in some cases, you're giving them as much as you possibly can to prove all the various things that you're doing, whether it's a credit or whether it's even just, you know, if you're a business owner and you're trying to show, you know, business income and losses relative to, you know, personal income, you're trying to do the best you can to, you know, we'll say optimize. Ideally, everybody pays no more and no less than they owe. And then you're also trusting as a taxpayer that the data helps keep everybody else honest too. So it's that perception that we always call it voluntary compliance, which I think just is Greek to anybody not in the tax world. But what it really means is that tax agencies have data that we respect, we secure, but then we also use to make sure the playing field is as level as possible for everybody, which is kind of why, I mean, I'm biased. I love tax administration because it starts when all of the, you know, the rulemaking and all that stuff happens. You know, laws get passed, tax code gets changed, whatever that may be. That's legislatures and executive branches and things like that. Then we get into tax administration where you're handed something and you're like, all right, how do we implement this fairly and equally across the board? And that mission combined with the vast amount of data that we get to work with and the success that people have with it. I mean, I was talking to Comptroller Learman earlier this year about some of the data matching that you were all doing. You were taking data that you had, you were assessing it for use, so the critical safety part, right? Making sure that you were able to use it for this purpose, but then ultimately helping people who may qualify for assistance or for tax relief or whatever it may be that they didn't know they qualified, figuring out how to get in touch with them. And again, it's making sure people don't pay penny more or penny less than they have. So it's the use of data is tremendous in tax, I feel like.
I agree. And I think we're still headed up the learning curve. I think we have a lot further to go because exactly what you said, I think predictive and proactive, right? Mm-hmm. Versus being reactive, which I think most of us are. I know we for the most part are. We certainly are baking things into programs we start ahead of time. But in terms of getting someone to do something they weren't planning to do, you know, we're just really going down that path.
And no, absolutely.
I think it's more and more important. You would think that all the tools we have, everything that's at our fingertips, that our tax base would be much more able to enroll in all the programs we have and know everything out there. I think they know less. I think we're all so over inundated with information that we're actually less knowledgeable in many ways at times. So it's going to become even more important to target and directly connect with the folks you want to connect with or even do things on their behalf. That's always a little bit of an awkward thing for me.
Sure.
Like I think it's awkward for the common citizen, right? Like this is America. We have a fragile relationship with our population. You know, we're generally distrusting of government to a degree, and it's a healthy distrust, right? Doesn't mean I necessarily want you registering me for this program, even though it might really benefit me. That might make me feel a little iffy, and I think we'll continue to evolve to that place, but I think there's going to need to be a lot of steps along that path. And kind of while I'm pulling that thread, and you mentioned this earlier with public trust, something we go back and forth with our legislature about frequently is them trying to apply different social policies through our tax forms or even social research through our tax forms. And it doesn't matter whether we agree with those policies or questions. Our concern is that the taxpayers view that as us harvesting more data beyond
Sure.
what we need to do our jobs. And then they become distrustful of the overall tax form, tax submission process. We do some stuff. We collect like whether or not you have health care coverage and some things like that, whether your kids have health care coverage. And we haven't done an empirical study on it, but we have seen that we did see a drop down in some of our voluntary filing metrics around that. We saw a slight uptick in paper during that first year. Some people wanted to submit that because they didn't have to check it on the paper.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Well, it makes sense. It's that push pull, right? I mean, I guess I can understand the policymaker perspective because what's the one form everybody fills out every year, no matter what, right? It's their tax return. But you're absolutely right. This is not just about what we do with the data, but asking for the data that we actually need to do the function of tax administration. And, you know, I imagine that's a very, I would say fun because I'm a data person, but a fun area, gray area to navigate because there probably are some questions that are helpful from a tax administration perspective, but they may not be ostensible to the person filling the form out as to why it's helpful.
That's right.
So that gets into your point about information and communication and how we even get that. Because I think you're right. We have the example I use about data inundation is a silly one, but it's one that I think anybody, regardless of your background, can understand. In the 1990s, you watched TV shows by week.
Right.
So, right? You watched an episode of a TV show, and you had to wait a week for the next one. This is before TiVo or DVR or anything like that. You got to the office the next day. Everybody watched the same thing you watched last night, if you're a fan of the same show. Got to talk about it. And then you waited, and you watched the next one. Now, not only do we have the ability to watch episodes whenever we want, most TV shows, they don't release them periodically. They just dump a whole season on whatever streaming service. But the permutations of available media have increased exponentially because we're not limited by the number of channels we can show one episode on in a given hour every night. Now you've got water cooler conversation or friend barbecue conversation where you're like, oh, have you seen this show yet? No, have you seen this show yet? I spend more time telling people I haven't seen the shows they're watching than I am talking about what I have seen, because we have so much data, so much entertainment data available to us. We're all self-optimizing, which is kind of cool. You get, if you really like Game of Thrones, they've got you covered. They've got a million seasons out into the future on that. And if you're, a Bridgerton person, you got that too. But we've lost that common reference point because now all we know are just the names of these shows that are flying by us at the speed of the internet. So to your point about, I think that's a silly example, but that problem exists everywhere, because everybody's putting more information out all the time. It's a fascinating data problem. One that I don't necessarily know that we can solve. This is where, a lot of people will point to generative AI. I might be one of them, depending on the context. But also putting a Band-Aid on the fact that we're generating more data than we can consume, might beg the question of what's the point of generating the data in the first place if you can't utilize it.
That's right. And how do you react to it? Mm-hmm. It feels like we're on an evolutionary arc around all of this right now, and it's still all brand new to us. It's still brand new. I think we have a long way to go along this path with where it's all going to land. And, we're going down a tangent right here, right?
Oh.
Right? Everybody can talk about social media and the impact it's had on our world and all of the data that it creates and how it gets used and how it might reinforce certain things and all of that. And they're right, but we're just taking our first steps. It feels like it's been forever, because it does feel like it's been forever. I had hair back then, but it's like we're at the beginning of this.
Well, yeah. Well,
I tend to be an optimist. I think we're going to overcome it. I think we're going to end up finding a way to become better because of it. We're just not
absolutely
there yet.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think this is the we had a smaller version of this when we were experiencing kind of unprecedented, the government and criminal dance is always ongoing, right? So every time, somebody takes a step forward, we improve, we improve fraud detection. The criminals find a different place that they could potentially attempt fraud, and then we're always catching and encountering. It's a maybe not so much a dance as it is, sword fighting, because it's very elegant in some cases. Like when you step back and look at the data, how we've traversed the last decade, we went from mass identity theft because of that wave of data that was available on the internet to people. People weren't securing their things. They didn't really understand what the importance of passwords and stuff like that were. We, largely solved that. Then we started to see fraud shift in other places and, detect and prevent that. And then what's interesting is the tax world has solved that. Well, then the broader finance sector started to see it because, we're optimizing to protect citizen data and tax dollars. Criminals are optimizing to meet their bottom lines. Being a criminal is a business, not a particularly good one. Wouldn't advise it to anybody, but they look at things like business people do. Mm-hmm. If I can't get my money over here, I'm going to try to get it some other way. The number of text messages I get from criminals saying that my Amazon package can't be delivered unless I press this link to verify the amount of anxiety I feel every time I read that text. Mm-hmm. I mean, social engineering and all those things. I mean, it's interesting to your point. And then you layer in social media on top of that, and that we're always having to evolve how we look at data, because I think some of the recent trends, there were social media promoted schemes that weren't criminals dealing information. It was people actively giving bad tax advice of, hey, you can claim insert thing here. Here's how you do it. Watch this TikTok. And then all of these tax agencies were all of a sudden seeing an increase in this data. And you have to pivot and adapt to how you use the data in order to, to protect the revenue and ensure that people are being honest. I think it's people are naturally honest, but when you in social media context tell them they can do something and, people don't necessarily always check their sources and verify that's a legitimate thing, you end up in this gray area where people are just trying to, pay the least they have to pay. They may not necessarily be an intentionally non-compliant person, but they think they can because somebody said they could and they didn't bother to say, are you three criminals in a trench coat or are you actually somebody who knows what you're talking about giving me this advice? Yeah, I super big side tangent, but I think we can tie it back, get back on track. Underutilization of data. You talked about this a little bit. We're always getting better. What's one data area right now, before we kick it over and talk about KPIs, what's one area of data right now that you think warrants kind of deeper innovation, a closer look? Like, what's a data type that you're particularly interested in right now? I know a lot of people are telling me economic data. That might be the case for you, but what's your favorite data
set? That one seems too obvious for me. Because it is, and it's blending, I will say for a minute, blending tax data with economic data is unlocks so many interesting avenues to look at policy. You know, we make pretty darn good use of our data, and I think most agencies do at this point. Like, I feel like we're really captured a lot of where we want to go. Like you're saying, KPIs and things like that. That is the highest value target typically. We're starting to turn it around and look at it with regard to our staff. I am fascinated at the demographics of my staff, ages and things like that, and trying to use it to identify gaps. You know, I know visually from walking around that I have a hard time attracting young talent. You know, I know that that's an issue. I don't know whether or not the predecessors six before me had that same issue. Is this just a thing in tax, right? Because as we said, not everybody jumps right into tax, right? It's a little bit of a path there, typically. But with, you know, I mean, I'm sure you remember, not long ago, especially pre-COVID, we were talking endlessly about the silver tsunami, right? The aging out of our workforce. And at that time, it felt like everybody was going to retire all at once. And that's not what happened. We still have a ton of folks here. We just had our annual service awards. And I mean, I gave out, I want to say, 30 or 40 different awards for people that were over 40 years of service. You know.
Whoa.
Yeah. Yeah. I've got one that's tremendous. 53 years of service right now. 53 years she has worked here.
That's diligently.
So, you know, yes, we've seen a lot of that turnover, but not the degree that we thought. And even as we anticipated it and were focusing quite a bit on how to handle it, it didn't quite play out the way we wanted to. So now I'm wondering if we can use some data to better predict the likelihood that certain people in certain roles are maybe more likely to exit in the near term. And then who's necessarily behind that person? And where do we think they are in their career? Kind of looking at ways to, you know, kind of plug different holes and just identify some opportunities. Maybe identify some people that we want to go maybe give them a little extra money, retain them for a few more years, be a little more proactive in our employee retention. But that's also impressive on the recruiting side. So.
Kind of optimizing succession planning, because I mean, like I said, it's a common problem. Every government agency, not just tax, right? You have a finite amount of leaders that you can work with in leadership programs every year, finite number of people that you can promote into positions, finite number of positions you have to put people in to begin with. But to know, you've got my data curiosity peaked, like to know what are the likelihoods of a vacancy coming up in a certain area based on the knowledge that you have historically of, you know, tenure, workload, time of year, whatever that may be. That would be fascinating, like almost like a, maybe not even a predictive model, but a suggestive model to help you point your development resources in the right direction. That's very cool.
That's right. I mean, we've done a little bit of bucketing, right? You see people that are job hoppers, people that are constantly moving, whether they're moving up or they're moving horizontal. There's a lot of different characteristics that you can attach to an individual that you can then be a little bit, I think you're right, suggestive versus predictive. I certainly would love to get to predictive, but.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've resisted the urge. It's been, you know, for 33 minutes to not, because you mentioned Walmart, now we're talking about predictive, we're talking about behavior. So now I have to break out the advertising hat. So, you know, I've shared on earlier episodes, you know, my education is dual, technology and advertising, because of a very interesting series of really great mentors. Not a normal combination for somebody, but you know, advertising, which all the ad agencies probably don't like me saying this, but advertising is kind of like evil psychology, right? Advertising is more about getting people to do something than it is.
Yeah.
You understand people deeply, but I suppose you're helping them if you think what you're selling is helping them, but you're really just trying to inform behavior. But I see so many parallels in especially data work. I mean, 90% of advertising these days was all data. It was getting that way when I was working in that industry. It's definitely that way now. I mean, just look at the nature of, you know, the two or three things you'll ask Google or Siri or whatever about on your phone, and then all of a sudden every ad you see is for that product category. I mean, and they're getting better, right? They're not just suggesting the same product over and over again. It's multiple. They're trying to you know, move you in the direction that you think you want to be moved. But when it comes to kind of the suggestive predictive behavior, I mean, these start to like sound a lot like customer profiles we used to build in the mm-hmm. advertising world, right? Like these are, you know, you talk about somebody who moves around a lot. Well, their satisfaction rating with their job may be highest when they're always doing something different. Yeah. So their best scenario is every 36 months, they like to be in a new role, a new area, learning something new. That's where they get satisfaction. So understanding those types of employees using this kind of data you're talking about working with would be super helpful, because then you don't accidentally have one of those folks get stuck somewhere for 5 years because you really need them there. But the trade-off between really needing them there and knowing what their motivations are, or what the data suggests their motivations are, maybe combined with working directly with the employee, right? We're not just trying to predict it without talking to people. But if you have that idea, maybe you'll make a better decision and you'll say, you know what, we really need somebody in that spot, but I need to keep this person more than I need to keep this person in that role. And a lot of, you know, it's the data and the art of management. I think there's a lot of places where people intuitively get that. You know, you get to know your staff, and, you know, smaller businesses have an easier time of it than larger enterprises. And most government agencies are larger enterprises. So you got to build that. That's a really, that was not the data set I was expecting you to talk about. No. But that's a really cool one. You give me great things to think about.
We talk about it at FDA all the time. It's all about our people, right? It's all about our teams, all about our staffs. You know, can't do anything with data without a team.
No, it's interesting. And you're right. We did. It was the silver wave, and then it was, you know, the great retirement, and then it was the great resignation.
Yes.
And it was all these things that were happening. They were all labeled great. None of them.
These hyperbolic adjectives in front of everything.
And really, I mean, a lot of them boil down to, it's the great workplaces need to realign themselves with their employees' expectations of what a job is. Like, that's really what, you know, doesn't fit on a bumper sticker, so I guess they can't call it that. But that's really what all these different waves have been about, is almost this warning, like, you continue doing exactly what you're doing, data is suggesting that you're going to see large shifts in workforce population. And, you know, the suggestive data never actually panned out to be super accurate, but then you have these other weird factors that come in. You know, a year and a half ago, state revenue agencies were having a really hard time recruiting because our federal partners at the IRS were heavily recruiting to build up different parts of the IRS. Then with changes in the last 6 months, now all of a sudden, no one's talking about recruiting challenges because there is a lot of really great qualified folks who are no longer being dedicated to that particular growth plan that the IRS had, and now their priorities have changed. So now that workforce pool has changed. So it's not even static in terms of understanding where people come from. And to your point, even earlier, everybody comes into tax such a different way that how do you even begin to predict where you're going to find your next great leaders from? Because there are tax courses, but there are tax courses for most people don't go become a CPA and think, I learned this so that I can go to a tax agency. You know, they're learning it because they're keen on, you know, capital calculations, things like that in the private sector. Well, this data we're talking about, I like your data set because it ties into KPIs really well. So KPIs, key performance indicators, they are either, for most organizations, the most successful thing you leverage mm-hmm. in terms of your data, or they spell certain doom for how you manage your organization. What's your philosophy on KPIs?
I love KPIs. I think, to your point of the value versus the doom proposition, you've got to set them up and you can't be rigid with them. You've got to let them change. You've got to let them evolve. You've got to reprioritize them. I think that's very important. Good example in Maryland, you know, I think we're kind of famous in the tax world for the fact that we, you mentioned we're a little bit different here in Maryland with our setup. Mm-hmm. Our comptroller is independently elected, so answers directly to the public. It is a statewide position. It is viewed as someone that might one day run for governor. Mm-hmm. And we are super sensitive, therefore, directly to the taxpayers from our top leader. And we get refunds out in two business days on average. Okay. Mm-hmm. 90% of our refunds for tax year 24 this season have been out by two business days.
That's wild. That's a business day better than you were doing when I lived in Maryland.
Yes, it is. Well, I'm rounding down, okay? We were at 2.8, 2.7, and now we're down to 2.4.
Even to be able to round down versus round up is impressive. Yeah. And you're right, this is something you all are 100% unique in doing. I don't think there is another agency in the country that has that metric. I mean, there's a few other elected officials that oversee the tax function directly in the state, but you all have had this mission for quite some time. And what I've always been impressed by is the data machine that you have that allows you to do it. So it's not so much that you guys don't recklessly release refunds in two business days. You validate data through a pipeline, and in less than three business days, a little over two business days, you actually deliver those funds direct to the taxpayer's account. That is incredibly impressive.
Yes, yes. And, praise to those that came before me. They built that ecosystem. I think I'm now the steward of it, but it was built by some people that were very forward-thinking. I'll circle back to where I think it plays into the KPIs. Mm-hmm. But just to go down that path, because you mentioned it, right? We're very proud of our fraud detection in Maryland. That was one way that I got into the administration side when I was, a lowly economist, and we were in the middle of a modernization project. We had some extra money. We had some data folks in, and we partnered with the firm that at the time was ASR. Now they've morphed into Voyatech. And we built the state's first, kind of modern fraud detection algorithm. And it was just a long algebraic equation, long linear equation. We programmed it into the mainframe. We tracked it. We began to build data around it, right? How good was it? And now it's become this very complex decision tree algorithm with machine learning capabilities and multiple paths. It's become phenomenal. But that's it. It's been an evolution, right? We've had to layer things on top to keep doing it because the world's been changing, right? It was one thing to be pushing out two-day refunds, back in the 90s when there weren't cyber criminals pumping out returns to you in mass with very, very well-done synthetic identities. But the world changed, and to be honest, we were a little bit lucky. It's not that we fully foresaw that was coming. We had some extra money, and we saw this one group that was doing fraud detection, and they weren't very accurate. They were 5% accurate, and we were like, that seems like an interesting problem to go solve. Let's go talk to them, and we went down a path, and thankfully we did, because we probably wouldn't be able to, but our tax base, it is embedded in them that they will get their refund in 2 days. I mean, we get phone calls on the third day. They are like, what is going on?
Yeah.
What is wrong with you? So we're circling that back to the metrics. I watched that metric the closest, right? Where, in terms of the volume I came in, where are those things sitting? It's very velocity focused, right? It's very velocity focused. But when you obsess with velocity, you leave behind quality, right? So I think that kind of gets to how do you find ways. Velocity will always be number one for us, but I need to layer in quality along with that velocity. And it's hard to do at the point of processing because you don't know that you made a mistake at first. You don't know necessarily how the taxpayer is being affected by that refund, whether it was what you gave them, whether it was slightly smaller, sometimes it's bigger. And so you really need to do some of the quality analysis, has been my experience, after the fact. Mm-hmm. So we really watch quality, but after the fact, and focus on velocity in the moment.
Makes sense. So you have both your kind of your real-time KPIs. So you have your velocity KPIs, and then you have your feedback loop KPIs.
Precisely.
Your post.
That's the right.
So something really interesting in the KPI world, I find, this is more manufacturing where it came out of originally, right? KPIs really blew up in the manufacturing world because they're all trying to, as you try to push towards, you know, whether it's better manufacturing process, you know, this just-in-time arrival, things on assembly line, KPIs helped begin. And then you have the whole, you know, all the GE methodologies that then seeped out in the rest of the business world. And, you know, for KPIs, a lot of organizations put them in place, and there's a combination of challenges, right? Either they collect data, they don't really know why they're collecting it, right? You know, what are you going to do with it once you collect it? Sometimes the people who you're tracking the KPIs on, and the IRS had this problem maybe it was 15 years ago or so, where they decided one of their key indicators for performance was going to be length of phone call. And all that led to was a bunch of IRS phone agents hanging up on people because they would watch the clock and they knew what metric they were shooting for, and they figured an angry taxpayer calling back wasn't nearly as bad as not meeting the metric. Obviously, bad outcomes of tracking KPIs. So when you, from your perspective, as you put these things in place, like, what are some ways that you implement them, not only to make sure the data is useful, but then to also make sure that you don't just get what you're measuring, that you're not sacrificing unmeasured quality for the sake of the quality that you're actually taking a closer look at?
That is exactly the right question to ask. I mean, that is where things get tricky, and that's where experience and leadership come in. I think you've got to be willing to accept that the metric that seemed like the right idea may not have been, but how do you figure that out? And I think sometimes, like in that case, maybe you're seeing that you're hitting that metric too well. Hitting a metric too well can be an indicator in itself, especially if it's shifting over a period of time and all of a sudden you're there. That's when it's too easy, something's wrong.
So do you see, I guess, to not interrupt your thought too much, do you see KPIs as an upper limit, aspirational? Do you see a target on them? Or do you see KPIs as more trend-based data and then you're interpreting them relative to success as you evaluate them?
I've gotten really into percentiles. So bucketing them and how many are happening within certain periods, you know, in a velocity point, like where are they within that? And am I comfortable? Because a lot of what we deal with is challenging. If I was getting 100% of refunds out in 2 days, I'd be really worried. I'd be really, really worried, you know? So I think it's never one number. It's then examining within that number and broadening your point of view. And being thoughtful around that, you know, and being commonsensical, right? Like, I think a lot of times people look at data as a way to overcome common sense, but I think that they are companions. I think they're necessary.
Absolutely. No, it makes total sense. Didn't mean to interrupt your thought there about going through and kind of, you know, when you're hitting a metric a little too well, that's suspicious. And then also I think you're getting into the second part of the question, which is when you set those KPIs, making sure that you're not, you know, sacrificing quality in one area for the thing that you're actually measuring, because, you know, staff tend to self-optimize, right? People who are working, they want to be seen as doing a good job. If they know they're being measured in one area and not another, even through no fault of their own, they're going to self-optimize to do the thing they're measured doing, because that's going to lead to, you know, maybe compensation or promotion or positive ratings, or maybe just a pat on the back, whatever it may be. So that makes it challenging too, I imagine, to pick things to measure.
It does. And you're headed right there towards, you know, it can't be all quantitative. It's got to be qualitative. You've got to be out there talking to people. I am strongly benefited by the fact that we have a very vocal staff. You know, they are not afraid to share their feelings and experiences.
That's awesome.
That cuts both ways, you know.
Yep.
But
it's a net awesome.
Always
probably.
Good. It's a net awesome. Of course it is. I mean, even the bad is good, right? I got to know. But they will, when they are seeing things that they think are wrong, and again, this is something I inherited. We have a very strong taxpayer service ethos here, like a culture. You know, we're not a, and this is not to disparage others. You know, I think some agencies come from it more of a very firm compliance standpoint, and they're very firm on that. We are very much a customer service centric organization, and so anything around that, our folks are telling us, and they're telling us quickly. So I think having the relationships is really matters with the boots on the ground. And I'll tell you, it doesn't always percolate through my chain of command. It's usually when I'm walking around on the floor talking to the boots on the ground. It very rarely trickles up. I think you need to get direct.
No, that's awesome. Well, it's interesting too, because I think some advice, some takeaways for leaders, and I've never really even thought about it this way before, because sometimes in the data world, KPIs are such a rigid thing. Like, what are your KPIs? What are your inputs? What are your outputs? What other data sources do you have? But when you start getting to the qualitative, I mean, I think this is an example of some people may have, in the technical sense, KPIs that they're tracking that they don't even realize they're tracking, right? It's that walking around as a leader. If you're walking around talking to people and getting that real-time feedback and understanding where that function is based on that feedback, that's a KPI. You just may not think of it that way. That's interesting.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. No, I agree. I think that's
so important. I know we're coming up. I could talk about this for hours, and then everybody would just drop off and not listen to any more of the podcast. I know that's what would happen. We'd have like the four really strong data people, and they'd email both of us at the end of listening. So thinking about everything we've been talking about, so data, how it informs KPIs, you all as a really sophisticated data shop, how you do things with your data warehouse. What are the, because you leverage some of the, some really current technologies. I would say not, a lot of times I'm talking to agents about modernization, like where they're looking to make improvements. I mean, you all, for the most part, as a practice, and I know this has been true for many, many years. I mean, even, so our executive director, Sean Bernardi, used to sit in your seat and at the Comptroller of Maryland, and that was always a focus of hers, was continuous improvement. It's all a lot of conversations I've had with you. I've had the conversations with the Comptroller herself. Like, what are those areas that are emerging that you are most intrigued by right now? Because I know you all tend to stay on the vanguard anyway, so it may not necessarily be something that you aren't already experimenting with, but what makes you more excited right now when you think about stuff coming down the pike and how that might make what you're measuring better? Is it new systems you're trying out? Is it new data you're thinking about measuring, maybe new data that you're getting you didn't get before?
Yeah. I'd say it's new problems. New problems to solve. I think you're right. We've always had a pretty mature data standpoint. One of my favorite jobs I had was working for Sharon and being her data geek. Like, I miss that. I really do miss that. I think that was we were in a very symbiotic place there, moving some things ahead. And Sharon kicked us off on the tax system modernization. And we're in the middle of implementing Revenue Premier right now. We've got the business side in. We're just learning that data. That data is at its infancy for us, and there's so much more of it. I'm really excited about where we're going to go with that. But honestly, we haven't dug deep into that yet. We're just getting to the point of developing even our KPIs around a lot of it. What really matters in that system? What does that data mean? How does it translate to our historic data? How can we? I'm very much about time series. Like, I like to see how things evolve.
Yep.
A point in time is almost meaningless. So finding ways to blend that old data with the new data. But I'm really obsessed right now with the new problems that we have. And in Maryland, it's been really twofold. One, and I did a presentation on this at FTA, with the salt cap that stuck folks at $10,000. We had Maryland residents that were paying, millions of dollars more in their federal tax because of that cap. And like many states, we passed a bill that allows the entity to pay on behalf of the members. And we were struggling to implement that. So they were getting the tax savings, but we were creating a massive administrative headache for them. We were denying, on a volume basis, 78% of credits. And the majority of these are, filed by professional CPAs. They're pretty solid. A lot of times it was a missing K-1, things like that. A lot of times it was so complex, our people didn't know how to synthesize all the information across different returns, different entities. And this is for a tax type that's still in our mainframe-based system. So they have to go and make sure the business actually paid the taxes, right, that we're going to now give them credit for. So many challenges around that. So we built a comprehensive data flow model that brought all the sources together, cleaned it, which was very important.
Nice.
And then we built in leniency as well. Like, if we could find that 90% of the credit was funded, we're going to go ahead and give that to the individual. We're going to chase it down on the business side, but we're going to go ahead and give it to that individual. We are now approving 92% of credits at first pass, and we've done a deep dive on that other 8%. Within that 8%, half of them are indeed, errors on our side. So we're still kind of working on training and education and improving that model we built around those. And then we have a number that it is, it's CPA error. CPA error is much higher than I think any of us really thought. So there is a misdirection there of what they thought they paid versus what was actually paid.
And that's a great example of what you were talking about before, is there's the things that you assume, and then a properly built data model will ferret out, where those gaps might be. And you may not have assumed at the outset that CPA errors would have accounted for a lot of the reason you were, because you knew that there was so much of this data flow that had to be ironed out. But that's incredible, not only to get the acceptance rate up, but then to also be able to quantifiably understand, like, where in the pipeline were things that weren't getting approved. Like, what were the errors, and being able to trace them back to the error source. And that's transformational. So this is like when we talk at conferences, I think you and I have said this many times, like the gold that you get from other organizations is understanding what's the interesting thing that you think is normal, because now it's just part of your workflow. You just use it every day. You don't even think about it. But no one else is doing it that way. Mm-hmm. That, to me, is the most valuable gold in the world. Like, I love talking about all the new tech systems and generative AI and modern systems, whatever. That's a lot of fun. The things that hold the most value are the boring things. So the things that, like, data goes in one side, comes out the other. What are you doing in that data pipeline that somebody else isn't doing, and that's leading you to higher confidence or anything?
So agree. I'll hit on one other example that I love.
Yeah, please.
Just went there. I think the other thing that I'm obsessed with right now, and this actually came back after an FTA conference, I am absolutely obsessed with taxpayer migration. I mean, everybody in the Northeast is, it's a problem all around the country. Not a problem, just a phenomenon. And, in Maryland, we are a high tax state. I say we're perceived as a high tax state, but it's a fact. We're a high tax state. I think you get a lot for that, but we are a high tax state. And we've always had a net out migration. We track that. When in my old economist side, we would see the state rich areas taxes, and we'd see an elevation in the number of folks that were exiting. But the problem is that data is so old. We all get it from the IRS, because most of us, we don't know what happened to our taxpayers, right? The IRS.
Yeah, you don't know where they went. Yeah.
Somewhere else, right? I don't know that they went to Florida or Arizona or Virginia. And so we've built this model that, again, is longitudinal, and it's a little different than what the IRS does. We do it based on their maximum income, because that's my theory, is that people don't base their decision based on that most recent year, which is how the IRS data is based. They do it based on what is their maximum capacity, their maximum ability. That's what they're thinking about when they're making those types of decisions. And to overcome the lack of data, my wife and I split our return in half, and I split our income evenly. Mm-hmm. Okay. So we're tracking individuals, not entities or returns. And then we just look at who's there and who's not. And then we look at that over a series of time. And our numbers that we're spitting out on this are very closely correlated to what the IRS has been publishing on our behalf. So we've really captured what's happening with our tax base. And the reason I became so focused on this, I think as many of us had during COVID, there was just a ton of migration, right? For a number of reasons, a ton of migration. And we saw it, and for the first time, we saw it very broad-based. We always focus on our high-income earners exiting. But we saw it across the board, you know? And with some of this data, one, we've seen that our lower income folks are elevating in their migration. And we have pinned that to high housing prices. We think that we're having a real problem there. We're partnered with the governor's office right now because we're seeing that a little bit more real time than they can at times. And then very interested in the high income earners. They pay, you know, in Maryland, the top 1% of our tax base pays 27% of our income tax.
Wow. So, okay. Yeah. So important group to keep an eye on.
They're an important group to keep an eye on. I didn't know what to expect with 2023. My early results that I'm seeing here are that we came back down to kind of a pre-COVID norm, even a little bit lower in 23, which is very exciting. I was very worried about that. I thought we were going to see even a continued acceleration. But then within that, it looks very different. It's actually our lower income folks have become less mobile, and our higher income folks are even more mobile. So it's going to be a very mixed bag of results is what I'm predicting for Maryland coming out of that.
Interesting. And what's interesting about your data results correlating so closely to the IRS data is that now you've identified so many traits in this model that you could perhaps, you know, to an extent, make it even somewhat predictive. You could even look forward and say, based on these factors, since we assume that our assumptions are correct, second order degree of assumptions, never good for data, but we'll say it is. If we assume that all of our assumptions are correct, then you have an idea of the weights of factors that will lead to net migration for different groups. And then, I mean, I could even just see that having being helpful in like policy modeling and, you know, things like that. Like, we have historical data that says if you do this with credit Y, we're going to see net in or net out migration based on, you know, historic data. That's awesome. I would equally be excited about that. That's awesome.
And I think where you're headed with that is where, like, we need to keep maturing this. We're at the very basic stage. We're just trying to match up with the IRS and have a little early info. But I want to get predictive. I so want to get predictive. And I want to understand it a little bit more. Right now, we don't understand the whys. And you know, you see some correlations of a tax change and certain higher rates. But I'd like to know more.
No, that's, well, I think you kind of sum up the notion of data work, really. Like, anybody will be able to tell how excited I am about this just based on how long we've been talking about it. But data is one of the most creative pursuits, right? Like, I was talking about this in terms of software and AI, but my argument that I make to people, the case I make, is that software development, data analysis, any of these types of things that are considered more science oriented and more rigid, and, you know, they've always been seen as that kind of number cruncher mentality. I argue that these are some of the most creative industries you can belong to, because when you're working with this, there is more creativity is required to even come up with the question to ask than anything else. I mean, in software, it's about how you design to solve a solution, and data, it's about how you look at something through a lens. So these, to me, are just as thrilling as like creative design problems, like how do you design a more beautiful building when you're an architect, or how do you, you know, paint a painting that captures a sunset perfectly? Like, this is painting with data to a certain extent. It's amazing.
I agree. It gets to that discovery. You know, and I think a common misapplication of the word in data often is bias. And there's this obsession with removing bias. I think bias can be very good. I think bias is where the people that are doing the work and are being creative, you know, if they have the right experience and they have the right sort of way of approaching things, you want them to inject their bias. That's a great starting point. And then they, you know, you prove yourself right, you prove yourself wrong, you move on to the next thing. But I think that creative, like, I guess I put bias into the creative part of what you were saying. You know?
Oh, absolutely. I think, yeah, bias has an overly negative context. I think, you know, the best way to, I think, describe bias broadly, and strict data scientists might disagree with me, but bias is the unique perspective of the data, right? Understanding bias is far more important than removing it.
That's right.
If you have data that skews a certain way for a reason, just knowing that reason can be valuable and can help you look at data different ways. If you
Absolutely.
took the largest, most unbiased data set on the planet is just a big bucket of everything. And that isn't even true because there's biases that exist within all of that. So by structuring data, by organizing data, you know, my last wild analogy, and I promise I'll ask you for your kind of final thoughts, but you know, data people are like the Zen gardeners of the computer world, right? Like you're out in your, you know, your, you know, Japanese Zen garden sandbox with your rake and your rocks and your bonsai. We're trying to make sense of chaos by looking at biases and looking at how you build better models and how you refine data, cleaning data, which we talked about very briefly, mm-hmm. which is why, I mean, I think coming back to it, your data for discovery is such a not only interesting perspective, but indicative of kind of how you all demonstrative of you all are leaders in this space, because that's one of your, you know, one of your key four areas you provided at the beginning. So I guess in closing, get your kind of thoughts. We always like to ask people for their advice. So as you think about your peers, and you've got a, you know, a few different types of peers, right? Whether it's agency leaders or whether it's people who are data leaders within their organization, what's some advice you would give your peers if they are aspiring to kind of get to the level that you all are at with just being willing to experiment and having that positive experience and experimenting? Sometimes they get it right, sometimes get it wrong, but how do they take that first step?
God, that's a tough question.
I gave you too many easy ones. I had to end with a tough
one. I mean, I think unfortunately part of it is you got to spend money.
Yep.
You know, beyond the tools, the people are expensive. We've been saying this too often around here, but you pay peanuts, you get a circus, right? And people are expensive.
Yep.
I think it's helpful to have a strong base and then try to build some state employee team around that. We started off with a bunch of folks we were trying to train up to play various roles. We went through this for 4 years where we invested a lot in folks, and every time we got them to a critical knowledge level, you know, they were going out to make a whole lot more money. They were not as invested in the agency as they were prior to that training. I think that's the hardest part, is planning that first foundational layer. And then it starts to grow, because then you do build a culture and an ecosystem, right? And it becomes self-reinforcing, but it's getting that initial layer, you know. I want to shout out Brandy Richman in my agency. She really took over the data warehouse from me as I began to move up. She's one of my closest colleagues and partners. And, you know, she has continued to infiltrate throughout the agency. I think something that Brandy brought to the table that I never had is she came from the processing side. She came from the boots on the ground. And she developed this love for data and figured out how to really apply it. And her talking to people about the solutions she could solve was so much more meaningful than me talking about the solutions the data could solve. And it just built a followership around the concept of data. So I think it's one, getting your foundation, and then it's finding people that are important to your agency and are strong communicators to be at the vanguard of your program, be out there, moving it forward, selling it to a degree, you know, because it is. When we first went down this path, it was selling. We had to sell it.
Sure.
We had to make compelling pitches. We had to twist a few arms every once in a while. It did get to that point, but mostly we were selling and it was voluntary. But I think that's it. It's getting that first foundation, that first win. It's almost like anything, right? Your first win, you get that taste. And then hopefully you've built something that is self-reinforcing. But it, as we were discussing kind of at the beginning too, it all comes back to people. You know, the data matters, the tools matter. You got to have the right people.
Awesome. Well, Andy Schaffel, Chief Deputy Comptroller, State of Maryland. This has been a fantastic conversation.
Yeah.
Thank you for finally, after much pestering, agreeing to sit down with me for an hour and talk about all this stuff. I just can't wait to see where you guys go from here, and I'm sure we'll have a lot more to talk about as all these different methodologies and tools and things that are emerging right now as they continue to come in, because, you know, and I know you all will be at the front of the pack testing them out. So thanks for joining me.
We're doing some cool behavioral stuff. We're coming for an FTA award next year. Everybody watch out. We're going to win the Data Creative Award next year.
Awesome. Awesome. Behavioral. Okay, so teasing our next episode together.
Yeah, that's right.
Awesome.
Thank you, Ryan. Appreciate it.